Hello and welcome to the popular show. If you're not a popular person, you should not be listening to this. It's a show about populism and pop culture with me, James A. Smith, and my great friends, Isabel Dan. How are you, Izzy?
Hello, James. I am excellent, thank you.
And the beauty from Newfi, it's David Slavik.
It's so good to be here. I had a belly full of mousse and a mouthful of beer. I'm just excited to be deep in Canada where we have socialized healthcare. And I'm far, far away from the United States.
We're extraordinarily excited to be joined on this show by Peter Coffin, who is a great YouTuber, podcaster, educator, and all-round excellent human being. Peter, thanks for coming on.
Other than the fact that, for whatever reason, my voice is just like, hey, it's time to go to crap now. I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on.
You've been drinking a fizzy drink. I think that might be.
Yeah, I've been drinking Dr. Pepper. It's coating my throat with the syrup.
Dr. Pepper is the absinthe of pop.
It is. I mean, it's for all intents and purposes, I think it's probably the best one because you don't have the entire like rooty taste of root beer. I don't know how to explain it, but you get kind of that taste, but also 22 other flavors.
No, it's absolutely true. And I as a fan of birch beer, I'm from Pennsylvania and that's like the home of birch beer. Birch beer is probably the best of all the colas, but I think that Dr. Pepper is a close and more available second. I know that I don't know if you are you from the South?
No, I'm from Michigan. You'll notice when I start saying A's, like it's very, very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice when absolutely. I say A's.
We're going to kick off with one of our regular segments on this little game show for the left, which is called Popular Pictures. And I guess I'll play the little live jingle for us. Popular Pictures. We've seen on the news popular pictures. Which one will you choose? I found this picture in my old desk drawer. The most popular picture of all.
Hey guys, I'm Yasmin Benoit, and I'm teaming up with Stonewall for Aromantic Spectrum Awareness Week to give you some tips on how to be an Aro ally. For starters, educate yourself about what being aromantic means. There's a lot of resources online. Be considerate of the way you talk about romance. It can be very alienating for aromantic people. Stand up for the aromantic community and call out discrimination. There's a lot of anti-aro attitudes out there and we need people to be vocal.
Today's popular picture has been circulated by the Stonewall charity, the LGBT plus charity, discussing the category of aromantic.
I've always sort of understood sexuality as being around sexuality. I did not understand that sexuality was around not sexuality.
So asexual, we're familiar with. This is people who, you know, do not experience sexuality or sexual desire. But aromantic, as described in the video clip, is people who have withdrawn from romantic feeling and romantic relationships altogether, which I think, you know, maybe we all know people like this. I think the kind of development that this represents is that the idea that this could constitute an identity in itself, a protected identity, one that other people need to modify their behavior in order to respect.
You know, it's interesting. I actually going to come out in favor of aromanticism. You know, as someone with twin babies, the romance is less than it used to be, but it's still there, of course. But I respect the idea of being sort of an ascetic, and you know, like really leaning into the idea that you're by yourself in some ways. Maybe you're having platonic relationships. Maybe you're even having sex occasionally, but there's a utilitarianism about some of these aspects and not being thrown into it. I think that actually does make sense in a way in the modern world where we are atomized. We're in a situation where, you know, you have to, you know, wear a mask just to go to the grocery store, you know, and like that's for a good reason. There's lots of reasons to not not to be engaged in romance, even though I would say that I'm a romantic.
You came up in the world of bread tube and the kind of online debates of the very online young left. So you're coming to us from the historical laboratory of much of the sort of negotiation of how gender gets talked about. You use they them pronouns yourself.
Yes, I do.
What's your take on this?
I'm a little bit, I am not, okay, so I don't think that it's a problem for anybody to be aromantic. I don't think that, I think that there are a lot of people who probably don't identify as aromantic that are what is described there as aromantic. And I think that that's fine. That's great. But to structure your entire identity around it, to make it a thing that you need to signify to people and that other people need to change their behavior around you for, I don't agree with that. I just am absolutely not with that. Like, if you come out and say that you're aromantic to your family, they're going to be like, okay, like, it's, your life is not going to change. Like, they might be irritating in the same way they might have been irritating before. Like, are you going to have kids? Are you going to do this? But that stuff is, it's irritating whether you are aromantic or romantic, straight, gay, trans, whatever. Like, they're going to have those same annoying questions one way or the other. And most of us don't really love getting those questions from our families. I sort of think of it from the perspective of, like, is there an actual material oppression at play for aromantic people that necessitates some form of aromantic activism? Absolutely not. Like, is it wrong that there's a label? No, but, like, is it something that there should be, like, identity based around? Probably not either.
The best tweet I've seen on this issue that kind of reinforces your opinion is that do you have to go to an aromantic bar to not get killed?
And exactly.
That's it. That's the tweet.
Yeah, that was Steve McLaughlin, a friend of the show. That's the interesting thing that I don't know. So it's a kind of, I guess the Stonewall video is about awareness, you know, aromantic awareness. We've got to be aware that this exists. And it's kind of a very interesting slide from kind of the idea of gay pride. There are certain kinds of activity that have in, you know, very recent living memory, and indeed like currently, that place you in danger. Yeah, that requires a kind of performative, stated defense or like announcement of identity. So much of like the origin of identity politics is in saying, you know, this identity needs protection because the enemies of that identity regard it as a coherent thing. So it needs defending on those terms. The very interesting kind of slippage or slides that we're seeing is one where by merely existing, a kind of persuasion or activity increasingly requires all of that process to kind of come into play. It's really interesting that your example, Peter, or your kind of illustration is like coming out to your parents. And I wonder if that infantilizing position, you know, whatever age an LGBT plus person comes out to their parents, they are momentarily infantilized by that. Even if you're 50 and you're coming out to your parents, it's kind Absolutely. Of I kind of wonder if this is yet another symptom of millennials, zoomers increasingly like having to defer like the luxuries and privileges of adulthood, less likely to own property, less likely to, you know, have the other kind of signifiers of adulthood, you know, permanent careers, et cetera, et cetera. And so more and more like ordinary human variety is getting experienced as, I don't know, developmental life crisis kind of thing that needs the protection of a charity, of awareness, of all us good progressive people kind of being aware and acknowledging this as a protected identity.
Well, you know, I see it with people who get like housing discrimination. I understand it. Like if a trans person tries to get an apartment and they're, you know, shut out of doing that, that's a serious problem. And there should be activism on behalf of helping that group of people not deal with that, because frankly, that's not acceptable in a civilized society. Right. But like here we're talking about something where like it's, and this is going to be a little bit exaggerated because I like trying to say funny things, but like, let's say you want people to be aware that you eat anchovies. That's kind of the same level of what affects your life here. Like, yeah, all right, you eat anchovies. Great. Good stuff. But it like, it's not, I hate to sort of rain on people's parade because I don't mean to say like you shouldn't be aromantic, you shouldn't you know, like David said, have platonic relationships and maybe sex casually. Like that stuff is not really a bad thing in any way. I don't have a problem with that. It's just, should this be a protected identity group? Absolutely not. It's adulthood in modern societies is sort of deferred, sort of a disillusionment or a defeatism, a sort of rational defeatism. And in a way, this is kind of like, it maybe kind of feels like a way to be special when you're in a world that just does not allow you to succeed in any way or get anywhere. It doesn't matter how much work you do. You just kind of like plateau at some point, and either that or head downward.
In a magical world, if straight people had to come out to their parents, you know, so many people be coming out as aromantic or otherwise? And it's just as someone who very much thinks, by the way, that straight people should come out to their parents, because the most embarrassing part of coming out, as any LGBT person will tell you, is just the face. Unlike any straight person, you have to talk to your parents and say, you have to basically say, here's the person I like to have sex with, and it's to do with sex. And it's very different than if you're just bringing someone home from a date, even though it shouldn't be different, because, you know, you take someone home, everyone knows why they're there. But, and yet, the parlance.
Or sometimes they hear you from the other room. You know? Thanksgiving can get wild.
Right? But the other thing with aromanticism, though, that video is quite, I mean, it's interesting and agreed that, I'm not trying to say that, you know, people shouldn't be this or feel this way, but if we're treating aromanticism as equal to something like, you know, bisexuality or any kind of homosexuality, you know, does it deserve the same airtime? I mean, arguably not. And in terms of also, it seems to rest on the notion of rejecting traditional romance, which is assumed to be the priority love and kind of relationship. And that is why people are coming out as aromantic, in order to reject that tradition. But it arguably reinforces that hierarchy. And then it kind of makes you kind of question, like, well, what about people's friendships and family? It does kind of make you question why it seems to be reinforcing this romantic ideal that people are trying to reject.
Yeah, I think that's really important. That's like so many of these sort of left liberal pronouncements, it kind of assumes a socially conservative society which doesn't altogether or universally exist, at least not in the way kind of invoked. I mean, if we had a conservative on here, they would be saying that the, you know, romantic love, marriage, you know, these are institutions that are long gone. I mean, you know, take family abolition, which is a category or a kind of leftist idea with a long and diverse history. But people who invoke it in a particular way now, as if the family is this kind of uniquely oppressive institution existing today, they very often kind of ignore the extent to which actually neoliberalism has abolished the family for quite a lot of people. There are plenty of people who would like to have children in whatever kind of family arrangements, who are prevented from doing so because they've just got no life security whatsoever. You can sort of see neoliberalism as having abolished the idea of being romantic altogether.
it makes you wonder. It's like, you know, as they say, and I think we've all heard this, and this gets repeated a lot, the idea of making up a guy to be mad at. And mm-hmm. I think in many ways we're making up an oppression to feel. And and I think that's important, you know. And I think like we're all there, you know. And as someone who's like recently married and having kids, now I get to be mad at people who don't want me to have kids, who I don't know who they are. And this is funny, and I want to, not to divert too much, but I was getting into incel forums, you know. My wife does some research on sort of like extremism and violence, and she's discussing these issues a lot. So we went down the incel forum rabbit hole. And what was interesting to me, it was like, and maybe I'm a little older, and I'm not that much older, but I'm old enough to remember when you just didn't get laid, you just like, I don't know, did something you wanted to do. And like, there's a liberation in that. And like, I'm wondering, like, is aromanticism the cure for the incel?
Yeah, that's fascinating.
I think no. I think it's probably not that. I think it's actually sort of... I mean, is it something that might end up those people might catch on to and maybe do? Maybe. But I don't think it's going to actually cure the problem that the incel has. Yeah. Because the incel ultimately, like, at the very core of that is it's not so much really about like their relationship with the opposing sex. It's this really internalized hatred of themselves as opposed to like, I'm sure
I think like the Bachelor, you know, like you're from Michigan, and I think you probably know people like this, friends of your family, older guys who, you know, just never got married. And they're not like, there's always this story of like Lindsey Graham, and they're like, liberals love to like, say he's gay because of whatever. He probably is, but I don't care, right? That's not my point with Lindsey Graham. But you always knew a guy who, like, he went fishing a lot, or like, you know, he got into carpentry and he lived by himself, and maybe drank a little bit, maybe didn't drink, but he was, you know, he did his thing and he was on his own, and there was a quiet dignity to that. And I think that in this era, in the neoliberal era, the performativeness prevents us from having that quiet dignity that a previous generations had have.
Well, yeah. Instead of that quiet dignity, you have to be loud and proud about a thing. Like, you have to be representation for that thing. If people know you, you have to be like everything about that thing to the other people that are aware that thing exists. Otherwise, you're somehow some sort of like traitor to that thing, I notice. I don't know. It sucks. It is the performativeness. There's the need to signal, the need to conform to a certain essentialist viewpoint of that thing. Like, all, like, if you notice, there's a lot of sort of biological essentialism in a lot of these. Like, you were this thing your whole life. You will always be this thing. And it's like, I don't know if I agree with all that, guys. I think that's kind of like the thing that they were fighting against a couple of decades ago and won.
Well, it's interesting. As someone who worked for a centrist think tank in Washington, D.C., and now is like a very out and proud leftist, you know, I can see like people have transitions in their lives that are pretty powerful. And I think identity often foregoes development. And that doesn't mean that you're not where you should be, or
100%.
It's absolutely, there's not just a continuum of sexuality or continuum of identity. It's a continuum of like self. And I'll be at times in my life, I didn't date, or, you know, I just did my own thing, and it was really nice. And I just didn't think about it. It was absolutely quite lovely. And now I'm in a loving relationship, and I'm quite happy with it. So it's, I think that had I put a label on myself, I might've been stuck there.
I think that's crucial. It's a really interesting example in itself, this aromantic thing, much more than asexuality, because it implies a certain like understanding of love. It assumes it knows what love is, actually. And it, when you start sort of pulling that thread, you kind of realize how contradictory it is. Like, whose identity is based on the fact that they fall in love? Only a certain kind of, you know, some sort of 18th century libertine who falls in love with successive women or something like that. What are we exactly are we evoking here? The idea that, oh, well, you know, it's my identity that I do fall in love, by the way. Like, love, if we want to get into it, is experienced as this kind of completely identity shattering, surprising kind of thing that you didn't expect would happen. And no one falls in love with the person that they described as what they wanted in their dating profile. The whole point is that Lacan said that love is giving something that you don't have. It's not what you thought you were that the person fell in love with. So the idea that I can come out as aromantic, you know, you're making some pretty big promises there, because insofar as love exists, you don't know what it is that is going to kind of strike you like lightning in that way. And you don't know what it is about you that someone's going to fall in love with. Lacan also said, by the way, that there's no such thing as unreciprocated love. If someone falls in love with you, it is only love if you have also kind of had this sort of lightning strike kind of weird experience that you couldn't reduce or explain by anything in your actual identity. So even that kind of specific, the fact that this kind of if we want to be that Marxist, this kind of commodified identity politics whereby everybody can only feel that they exist on this simulacrum of a social plane if they can explain themselves by this finite identity. The fact that that logic has extended into not just sexuality, okay, we can sort of understand it there, but into this kind of, you know, more sort of strange and really philosophical sphere of love. I feel like actually this isn't just another random example. Oh, another identity has been made up. Actually, this is maybe the one that sort of betrays the logic of the entire thing.
Could be. There's a gentleman, I can't remember his first name. He's a professor by the name, his last name is Mahler, but he has been talking about how we're constructing identity nowadays. And his kind of thesis is about profile building identity, like mm-hmm. basically building a public profile of yourself and living up to that, so to speak. And that's the mode of creation of identity in this sort of social media dictated world. And I think that really has a lot to do with this kind of identification showing up. I think that in this mode where you are more or less constructing a person to display publicly and then attempting to live up to that person, something like this might be like a sort of intrinsic or primary feature that you might consider yourself to be, that you would want other people to go, I'm not in a relationship. Maybe I'm that. Maybe, yeah, thank you for saying that. Thank you for giving me permission to do that. And give it, Alex Mahler, yes. I just think it's a really, really interesting way of looking at things, this sort of profile building identity creation. And I feel
whatever happened to being queer, you know, it's like, you know, just,
I don't know. A lot of us are hanging around doing that still.
Yeah, yeah. You know what I mean? That's the thing is that, and I think that's like, it's a beautiful thing. And it's funny because I kind of envisioned sort of like some sort of cyberpunk future where everybody's kind of like having sex with everybody. And it's like, you know, we're just doing our thing, man, you know, and maybe we're getting injections of something and like, maybe we have an implant, you know, and that's kind of how I saw the future going down. I didn't envision like more borders in our lives, yeah. You know?
Yes!
I thought we were just getting funkier. Like, I think we're going to get funkier and everybody's going to be funkier. And you're just like, yeah, it's just what I do. And you know, sometimes I do space coke.
The cue was kind of meant to say, and who the fuck knows what's going to happen. Maybe some other stuff's going to happen. We're not going to try to sort of define that in advance. But then we carry, you know, not to get Dave Chappelle on this, but we carry on adding the letters. Yeah. But every letter that turns up after the cue is actually a sort of betrayal of the cue.
Well, yeah, except for I'm going to say Two-Spirit is very legit, but you know, that's the two S I like a lot here. I mean, I'm sitting on you know, occupied land here. But you know, it's interesting, but those sort of identities are flexible in a way that I think that we're not allowing ourselves. And I think it's really exciting that we're in a world where we're like really accepting each other, but it's also like really difficult that we're not accepting ourselves and the ability to change.
Yeah, that flexibility is core, absolutely, because as well as reinforcing this kind of traditional hierarchy of love, it seems like the discussions of aromanticism seems to it rests on the notion that any one person only loves in one type of way, like in their romantic love. And you know, if anyone has fallen in love more than once, you know, chances are it's you love people for different reasons, and you know, the relationships might be very different, but they all fall that under that umbrella of love. But then also, I have to ask as well, like, so do people not have romantic friendships that aren't sexual, for example? And also, some friends are really great to fuck, and all of this can exist, surely.
That whole history of the ambiguity of the very word friend, as having a kind of queerness in it. I mean, the other sort of thing that interests me about the incel comparison is the way in which, like, so much of the, with our kind of polarization of politics right now, it's almost like you can always find the sort of mirror image on the left and the right. So, you know, the liberal left apparently reasonably doesn't accept the result of the 2016 US election, never accepts, you know, Trump is not my president, never accepts that Brexit was a legitimate vote, and then is surprised when the right does the same thing in 2020. And those kind of liberals who spent the whole Trump presidency and the kind of years of the run-up to Brexit obsessing over, you know, Russian interference or trolls, etc., etc., those people suddenly are surprised or can't see the mirror image when the right has its own version. And, you know, because the aesthetics are different, because one group has got like buffalo horns and a Confederate flag and the other side has got, you know, a column in the New York Times, because the aesthetics are different, they don't see that actually this kind of the same anxiety is being expressed, the same sort of sense that you don't trust institutions anymore. I think that's happening in the sphere of sexuality and the sphere of love, that these neets, these guys without great kind of, career prospects, etc., they experience the fact that they are deprived of this kind of ideal that, of course, never really existed, of love, romance, sexuality, marriage, etc., that never existed in any kind of total way for anybody. They identify as incels as a result. Okay, I have to have an identity to explain this. I'm an incel. Meanwhile, the downwardly mobile millennials, Zoomers, who nonetheless kind of believe in the professions and want to save the profession so that they can get a piece of the pie, but nonetheless, they're kind of excluded from it for now. Very similar kind of affective constellation, very similar kind of experience of like not belonging to something that used to exist in their minds that they want to exist. And so they grab an identity as well. Oh yeah, well, what about me? I still like to have sex, but I don't have any prospect of stable romantic relationship or a long marriage like I imagine all my parents' generation did. Okay, I'm a romantic. it's the same kind of impulse. Like, I need to have an identity to protect myself from this kind of deep sense of instability and this deep sense that the social contract has broken down. But I'm definitely doing it in a totally different way to the people on the other side of the political spectrum. There's no possibility that we might be having the same kind of impulse or problem here.
I would almost say that it's interesting in that while I don't know that I consider this a legitimate grievance, the incels actually have a grievance, which is that they can't get sex. Whereas the aromantics are sort of defining themselves as like there is, for all intents and purposes, a lack of grievance at all here. Like, you could understand why an incel would want a group of people who have the same problem as them. What is the problem that an aromantic person has? That everyone wants to have a romantic relationship with them? Like, I don't know. Like,
can you guys just back off? Can you back off for 1 second?
I'm just too hot.
That's the problem.
I'm so hot and so smart. Got a great personality. Everybody just wants to be around me all the time, and I can't take it. Now this girl's melting on the beach. Oh, they're so fine and so out of reach. Cause I'm stuck in traffic down here on 53rd Street. Not sure if my love for you is real, but I didn't count on this package deal. And baby, this car just ain't big enough for her and me.
There's a company called Byte Labs. ByteLabs.org is making a meat out of human cultured cells. And they are, it's interesting because as someone who's at least slightly Italian American, I love a good salami. I love a soppressetto. I love, I love a capicole. I love a gabagool. They're seeking to make salamis and deli meats out of human culture.
We know about kind of the popularity of vegan meat. There are vegan burgers that bleed beetroot juice to imitate the experience of eating real meat. The next phase on is essentially cloned meat. So this does away with the ethical implications of killing animals and the environmental implications of factory farming. And now we've got this crazy twist, as Dave is describing, of a company that is offering us the chance to eat cloned human meat, and not only that, but cloned celebrities.
They advertise, and this is what the LA Times has picked this up in a story where they said, would you eat Ellen DeGeneres? What I want to know is, would you eat a cultured human meat? Do you eat meat? If you do eat meat or not eat meat? And second, is this crazy?
I hope that this doesn't happen personally. I think that it's a new kind of celebrity worship and believe me, I think that you'll find that the sort of like self ID performative leftist type will find this amazing. They will actually literally eat the rich. And,
interesting.
I think that it's actually a thing that they will make video. I think that if this happens, it'll be a thing that you'll see a bunch of videos of people who like hate capitalism, or at least claim to, eating, Brad Pitt or whatever, yeah, and saying like, "Eat the rich, man."
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think this is interesting because it's kind of like the celebrity fleshlight of food.
Yes,
and I think that's interesting. The interesting part about this, and Peter, this is why I like you, is that I had not thought about the performative aspect of this. I thought, surely people from a material condition will see that this is the commodification of the idea of veganism. This is the commodification of the idea of what good living and good clean eating is. This is, people will reject that, that we're going to live in the pod and eat the man meat. But you're saying that the people actually will buy in. And I think that
people will buy in. I think people who think that they are actively against the system will buy, like, and this isn't to say that the actual moral choice of veganism I disagree with in any way, or to say that it is moral or immoral to be vegan or to eat meat. I personally think that morality is an individual thing. It's not an argument I get in with people. However, I think that the consumer market that is created around vegans and veganism is, it relates very much to what we were talking about in the other segment about the identification, the sort of profile building, all of that type of thing. It is very much about signifying that you're consuming the right things and doing the right thing for the environment and doing the right thing for this and that. And even though it's really just not actually doing a whole lot, because vegan market is something like 4% of the food market. It's a very small amount of the food market. I don't remember the exact number. If that's incorrect, please don't cite me on it. It's not a big segment of the market. I mean, there are a lot of products, and a lot of them are actually very good. The Impossible Whopper tastes as horrible as the Whopper. the Impossible meat you can buy and grill up on your thing, it's actually pretty good. I've had it. I don't think that it's bad. I enjoy it.
I had it,
this week,
actually.
It's not a nice bad.
Carbonara, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not bad stuff. It's pretty good. But it's ultimately about consumerism and consuming and creating like some sort of consumption path for you to stay on. And you know, in this case, it's people who have found that factory farming is untenable and that it is in a lot of ways brutal the way that they keep animals and kill them. And they basically store them tightly packed. It's brutal and awful. And it's not surprising that when people find that out, they're revolted by it and want an alternative. So when they find the people like that, they have a consumption path for those people to basically become harmless and also to continue to consume something. This is that, but it's like, A, we want to be able to maintain the ability to eat meat totally. And B, celebrity worship.
Yeah, and it's actually, if it's as a lapsed Catholic, I would say, you know, you think of the body of Christ, right? Like, mm-hmm. like there's this transfiguration.
I know where aspect. You're going with this.
Yeah. So right. Okay. So there's this transfiguration aspect. So you're like, it's like the idea that when you consume this thing, this unleavened bread, when you drink that wine, you are actually taking the blood and the body of Christ into you. It becomes part of you. I find that quite disturbing, you know, and not to be religious about it, but I think that there is like, it's not about sacrilege. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's, you know, this is not like eating pork in a Muslim country. That's not what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about the concept of it. The interesting aspect of this whole Bite Labs argument is they actually do not have a celebrity signed up. They have an opportunity where you could tweet at the person to sign up. And that's what's really fascinating is this is actually all aspirational, which is just actually like, I don't know if they even have a product, right? Like, I don't, there's no product in the labs. I think they just want to get their hands on some meat from the celebrities that they had discussed. Interesting enough, these are the celebrities, and I want to hear your opinion on this. James Franco, well, we all love James Franco. Is a very attractive man. I think we can agree on that. You know, problematic at times, but you know, good actor. Sure. As you know, Jennifer
probably
Lawrence,
good meat.
Yeah, but lovely, I'm sure. Jennifer Lawrence, you know, I saw Mother. If you've seen Mother, the Darren Aronofsky film, was an awesome movie. You know, really kind of a consumption of Jennifer Lawrence in that film. My question is, if you were going to eat a celebrity, what celebrity would you eat?
All things considered, the whole the lapsed Catholic thing that you just said makes me really not want to answer that.
I want you know, people who eat the body of Christ. I want to drink the bath water of Christ. You know, the eagle who's
Delphine something.
This is the point. We're all e-girls now.
We are, yes.
This is a bit like the aromantic thing. Okay, of course, on some level, this only exists because it's going to get attention in the attention economy of online media. Yeah, as David says, that they don't even have a product here. They don't even have the celebrities. Although I am interested in the black market of cloned meat, where, you know, I go up and stumble and shake hands with James Franco and like just scratch his wrist a little bit with my long fingernail, and then we clone him from that and eat him.
But that meat is like partly fingernail meat too, because when they scrape your fingernail, they're gonna get some of you in there, I think.
Well, that's the black market. You risk having some.
It's low grade James Franco.
I don't want my James meat stepped on. You know, it's like when did this get shipped in a tuna from Mexico?
This is not high quality James Franco. This isn't fully James Franco.
I taste baby powder in this James Franco.
I taste a little James from the popular show in this.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, you know, like, that's, you know, it's why I don't eat ground meat very often. You know, it's like there's this idea that, you know, if we are actually going to eat the, you know, and this is the funny thing is that a lot of people who don't eat meat do so because they believe in the soul of the meat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you, and this is not to get too existential, but can you take the soul out of the meat, even if it's cloned?
This is important because this really points to the sort of philosophical shift that's occurred in the age of impossible meat and cloned meat and so on. Up until recently, the kind of left progressive utopian response to like damaging things that we do in our lives, be that you know, social attitudes, misogyny, homophobia, mm-hmm. racism, or be that damaging human activities like eating meat, causing environmental damage and so on, the stress would be on like identifying the kind of root of the behavior or the attitude or the human problem and seeking to kind of change that in some fundamental way. So is it Carol J. Adams, I think, is the author of the book on meat as a feminist issue. You know, that consuming meat is rooted in patriarchy and so on. That is the kind of traditional kind of left way of approaching these problems. What we see now is the kind of idea of a kind of almost libertarian offer, where you don't have to change anything about your consumption habits or anything about your attitudes or anything about you. You can continue with those completely unreconstructed, but we'll simply remove the malign elements. It's like the Zizek thing that neoliberalism offers,
the Starbucks
without caffeine. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It offers
it's fair trade. It's only like a well-paid labor or something like that, which is, I mean, it's ultimately not true either. Yeah. But like
This goes on to his other famous sort of story that I think people like to do. And I given that I kind of look like Zizek, I could do it, but I'm not going to do it out of respect to the man. But
what are you going to do?
It's right. It's right. The one thing I would say is that, you know, he talked about this instance of two disembodied people using machines to have sex with each other while they had a good conversation. You know, like you're outside of it, and you know, this goes back to, you know, just to square the circle, the aromanticism aspect of meat. And it's the question is like, if you're going to do something that is maybe inherently you know, maybe Jesus was a vegan, I don't know, but if we're going to do something where we're actually ingesting the soul of something, should it be in the soul of something that's actually existed? You know, is it ethically, or is it better
to eat a moose in the shell?
Yeah, exactly. I love ghosts in the shell. So
I'm
a vegetarian myself. I'm one of those vegetarians who people talk about, oh, the smell of bacon or you know, a steak or something like that. It's never been that has sort of made me, you know, meat curious or whatever. It's always the most kind of obscene sausages, you know, this French stuff where the kind of organs are pouring out of this kind of disgusting intestine, that kind of thing. And I think that for me, that points to a way in which, yeah, I totally agree with that. That like, if you're going to eat meat, it should have this kind of sense of the sacrificial about it. You should, I think that the experience of eating meat should be like, I understand that something has died for this experience. I kind of wonder if actually it is possible that cloned meat would kind of lack that sort of sense of the transgressive disaster that meat should involve. I basically think that, like, you know, ideally everyone would like kill the animal themselves and then you're entitled to eat it. Then you've made this kind of sacrificial gesture. That's what I'd replace factory farming with, just like, you know, open plains where you're allowed to go and hunt and you can eat whatever you killed there.
Yeah, well, in all honesty, I think that that's probably a good alternative, but I also think that I'm not against the lab meat thing. I think that it's probably a good idea, but I think that it has its own problems. Ultimately still exploiting people like along the line, like mm-hmm. we're still exploiting like workers, we're still exploiting, you know, there is going to be a factory, there's going to be packaging, there's going to be distribution, and there's going to be exploitation along the way there. And ultimately somebody will make a lot of money off of it and they'll hold a lot of power in some way. There's still a lot of problems with it, but I think that in terms of this, we kind of live in a pretty secular society at this point, like the lapsed Catholic thing and all of that. Like I went to Catholic school. I was a Catholic. But I really don't think about a lot of this stuff anymore when I, mm-hmm. when I consume things, when I do that, cause I don't really connect the act of consumption very much with morality. I consider it kind of a utilitarian thing, and I look at it from the perspective of what is wrong with the production process here. And I think that our current situation with meat, you can't answer things are okay, like we're just doing the right thing. Like I agree that a better solution is certainly the kill it, eat it, understand what goes into that steak on your plate. I think that's a great situation, but I also think that if we can create something that we're not actually killing and we're not actually, you know, using tons of land to raise, and we're not like something like over 70% of the soy produced is actually for feeding animals, and it ends up deforesting the like area much faster than the actual farming of the animals. It's the creating the feed and all of that. I think that the lab meat solution kind of eliminates that large segment of the problem of meat consumption, or meat production rather, where the end user, the consumer, the person, like there's so many things about modern society that you can't put the genie back in the bottle on. And I think that's kind of one of them, because it's a production process that evolved along. Like we were eating meat when we were hunter gatherers, we, you know, settled down for agriculture and all that, but that didn't stop us from eating meat either. Meat has been a part of human society for a very long time. It's that the production process we've created is just basically evil. Like if you see any of those pictures, like you can't be like, this is great, I love capitalism.
Not to mention the implications of pandemics.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. You think about the workers' conditions. You know, it used to be that we just thought about the cows, right? Mm-hmm. Or the chickens or the pigs, and now it's actually I would say a growth in liberalism, you know, not leftism, mm-hmm. but liberalism, that people are actually considering the workers now, because for so long it was about just the cows or just the chicken or just the pork or just the pork. That's my bias, right? Just the pigs. Yeah. But, you know, now we're actually considering, okay, there's COVID involved. And now I don't think we're going to consider COVID again, because, you know, Joe Biden's in office now, and all those bad situations are now gone, right? Like workers are being treated well. Yeah, it's absolutely fixed. You know, like in the workers in Amazon, they're all unionized now, I think, right? Because Joe.
One really interesting thing to me about this cloned celebrity meat idea is that it kind of provides a weird bookend with an idea from basically the very beginning of capitalism. Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal from the early 18th century, this remarkable satirical pamphlet that Swift produced. Swift was kind of ambiguously Anglo-Irish. He was between England and Ireland. When he was in England, he was contemptuous of the English attitude towards the Irish. When he was in Ireland, he was contemptuous towards the Irish. He wrote this thing where he kind of pretended to be recommending that the solution to poverty in Ireland was that the Irish should start eating the children of the poor. So the modest proposal in question is this, it's this kind of long argument made in the perfectly kind of reasonable kind of voice of the Enlightenment, that actually the best thing for everyone would be to start eating Irish children. It's fascinating to me that, like, kind of this early, kind of early critique of capitalism actually coming from this Tory satirist should find a kind of bookend at our end of the history of capitalism with the apparent, like, inverse, that, like, the fantasy now is eating the most elite figure that you can imagine, Kanye, Ellen, etc. Somehow it's the reverse fantasy, but ultimately to the same effect.
Actually, eating the Irish children is good. It's very good. I mean, the clones of the Irish children, but...
You know, there's nothing more aromantic than a clone, I think, right?
Oh my god, can we just get us ourselves all a clone to have sex with and, like, just basically ignore all of the other time?
I'm not gonna ask you that clone question about whether you would have sex with your clone, but I'm gonna ask you that question.
I think I just answered it for you anyways.
But we are in this situation where, you know, we are using our consumerism as a way to virtue signal and all those types of things. But it makes me really wonder, like, you know, what is the way forward here? And I'm going to ask the question that I ask everybody, Peter, and this is the most difficult question I'm going to ask. It's an unpopular question. It says, what could we do better? What's one thing that we could do a little better to make our lives a little better and better for the left?
Well, we could stop with the delusion that consumer activism changes anything. That's just, I mean, is it going to make you feel better? Probably not. I know people will say, don't yuck my yum, just let me have this, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, a thing that we could do that would at least have a means to prompt us to real action would be to stop with the collective delusion that consumer activism is actually changing anything. Again, like what I talked about with the soy production and the deforestation, that alone should tell you that there's a serious problem. Like 4%, I do know that this statistic is correct. Between 4 and 5% of soy that is produced, that goes into food and into, like, tofu. There's, like, very little soy that is produced that is actually going into the vegan food market. Most of it is going back, again, like I said, into animal feed. And that kind of statistic alone, you should go, oh, well, me just buying vegan food is not actually changing this thing. Like, it's created a small niche market for veganism, which, again, isn't bad. Like, it's good that that stuff is out there for people, that people have that choice. But it also isn't doing the thing that we've been sort of purported to be doing when we buy into a sort of lifestyle and the products that come along with it. If we could just break that collective delusion as a left, that would make us a better left.